one of these days, things gonna change. One of these days.
Thank you, John Lee Hooker, and thank you, Carlos Santana, for providing us, as always, with music and words to listen to. This is Economic Update. My name is Richard Wolff. Economic Update is a weekly program about what's happening in the economic parts of our lives. Our goal is to cover the most recent important events, but also to pick one or two basic economic issues each week to examine in detail. The purpose of Economic Update now is to examine an economy in trouble and undergoing change. For that change to really benefit the majority of people in this country, we have to know more than what is happening. We need to know how our economy could and should change in ways that would better serve our needs. We try in this program to do all that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I teach in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. You can follow my economic analyses at www.rdwolf.com. I also want to thank Truthout, whose remarkable website is a courageous source of independent news and commentary every day. Check them out at truthout.org. Thank you also for your questions and comments, which we welcome. Each week we select one or more. You can email them to me again at the website rdwolf.com. Let us know if you would like us to mention your name and the town from which you write. Please also become a fan of the show on Facebook and like our Economic Update page. By following us, you will receive updates about the show and posts of relevant articles and information. You can post questions for me to answer on air there. I will answer some there and some on the air. All right, let's turn to the economic updates for today. I've chosen a couple of issues that have repeatedly come to my attention from your comments, your questions, and even from those of you that meet me on the street and have a few words about the program, which I appreciate. So the first of these has to do with governments taking over enterprises, taking them over from private enterprises or starting them up all by themselves as government enterprises instead of private enterprises. This has been in the news recently because in a dramatic gesture, Argentina took back the oil company that had actually been started by the Argentine government, had been sold by the Argentinians to a Spanish oil company, and now the Argentinians have decided that the way that the Spanish company managed its subsidiary in Argentina was not acceptable. And so the government is coming back. I'm not interested in the details, the haggling between the Argentinian government and the Spanish oil company over the price that is going to be paid for this takeover. What I'm interested in is the connection between governments taking over enterprises and the question of capitalism versus socialism. Since a great deal of really strange and often silly things are said about this. So let's begin. When governments take over enterprises, buy them, or require the government to take over an enterprise, everyone should understand that there's no country on earth that doesn't give the government of that country the right to do that. Here in the United States, for example, we have laws. They usually go by the name eminent domain. These laws give government the right to take over private enterprises and private property. They are supposed to figure out a reasonable basis for what they cost and pay the private owners for that. But the private owners are not allowed to say no. The government is given that right as representing the interests of the community. That has been true throughout the history of the United States. There are indeed all the time examples where cities, states, and the federal government have done that in our history as a nation. So there isn't anything extraordinary at all about this as a principle. Why, one might then ask, is all this fuss made? And the answer is that private capitalists, private owners and operators of businesses, are worried and always have been worried about the idea that a government elected and responsible to the majority of people might choose to take over an enterprise and run it not for the profit of the owners, not for the high salaries of the top executives, but rather for the general benefit of the population. This is a scary prospect to private enterprises, so they have always been nervous and upset by the rights that all governments retain to do exactly what I just said. Let me give you some examples drawn especially from the United States. We have a long history of the government operating enterprises for a variety of reasons. Let me give you the example of the post office. The original idea for the post office was simple. Everyone needs it. Every business needs to be able to send out bills, to receive payments, to work out the details of contracts, and so on by using the post. And remember, the postal system was set up long before we had the internet, email, and so on. Everyone needed the post office, and so there was the fear that if a private company or companies were to run the post office, they would take advantage of the desperate needs we all have to charge unbearable prices and to make themselves a bundle of profits. So it was decided in the United States, as in most other countries, that the postal service would be an enterprise, would hire workers, but would not be a private enterprise, would be run and operated by the government. Not only was that not opposed by private enterprises, it was wanted by them. It was a way to assure that postal services that every business needed would be provided at affordable prices. The same applied to the United States government when it ran the Amtrak train system or all kinds of other transportation systems like superhighways, throughways, and so on. These are things that the capitalists of the country need. They do not want to be charged very high prices for them, and a solution is to have the government run them at relatively low prices. Wow, this might help us explain something. Private capitalists who arranged for many of the government enterprises to be run and did so precisely in order that they charge low prices have had a good time turning around and pointing to these companies and saying, gee, they're not profitable, and to suggest that the reason they're not profitable is that the government doesn't run businesses well. That's unfair and a bit of a hustle. The reason government enterprises often don't turn a profit is that's what they were intended to do. They don't earn a profit because they're not allowed to charge as much money as they might otherwise get away with. That's what private capitalists want them to do. The last thing private enterprises in America want is a postal system that actually is profitable, because if it did that, the postal system would have to charge all those businesses a lot more for the postage than they now pay. And there are still other examples where you can see a slightly different mechanism at work. After World War II, the American working class had progressed enough to demand the opportunity for their kids to get higher education, to go to colleges and universities in huge numbers that had never done that before. The problem in the United States was that we had a system of private colleges and universities geared to a tiny proportion of our population, the rich, the elite, who sent their kids to school before World War II and were used to going to college. In order to accommodate the mass of the Americans thinking about sending their kids to school, we had to consider expanding the sheer number of colleges and universities hugely and in a very short amount of time. The private schools of the United States, the private elite colleges, didn't want to do that. They wanted to remain small, private, and elite. They didn't have the money to do it either. So that was decided to be a government enterprise. That's why out of the 15 million Americans who go to colleges and universities today, 12 million of them go to public colleges and universities. Higher education is overwhelmingly a public government-run enterprise in the United States. And very few people object to it. It has been crucial in keeping the United States a competitive economy. It has done more than the private schools ever did in training the bulk of young people with high skills in our economy. And I don't think a serious person exists who would question the enormous benefits to the United States from this public enterprise. Okay, Amtrak, post office, higher education colleges and universities. Well, let me give you another reason why the government has taken over enterprises in the United States. It's when they have really screwed up big time and they threaten the entire economy. That's the concept of too big to fail. And the most profound example in recent history is the largest insurance company in the world. Something called AIG, stands for the American International Group, an insurance company based in New York City that, as I say, was the largest insurance company in the world. The United States government took it over back in 2008 and remains the owner and operator of that enormous enterprise. Why? Answer, the insurance company AIG insured huge amounts of financial instruments by means of something called credit default swaps. Those financial insurance policies, really what they were written by the AIG company, and they were the backing behind all of those fancy securities that went belly up in the great crisis that hit this country in the autumn of 2007. Pension funds across America, governments around the world, countless individuals all had invested in securities insured by AIG. But AIG hadn't managed its business real well and couldn't pay the policies off. That meant that pension funds around the country wouldn't have the money to take care of the old people that depended on them. Governments would be unable to continue to function because their investments had turned sour. So the United States government realized that if they let the AIG Corporation collapse because it was a defunct private enterprise that had failed, so many people would be hurt that it was an unacceptable social arrangement. So the government came in, took over the AIG company, and guaranteed all the policies that that company had written, but that that company could not honor. Did people object? No. Did Republicans and Democrats support this? Yes. And they still do. That's why the government still owns AIG. So there it was a case that other capitalists who had invested in these securities and rich executives who had were very happy to have the government come in because they would have lost their shirts otherwise. These are all examples of government taking over or operating private enterprises from the beginning, not as an alternative to or a threat to or an opposition to capitalism. On the contrary, these are examples of governments taking over enterprises or operating enterprises whose purpose is to support enhance and subsidize private capitalists. That's why to call a government takeover of an enterprise socialism is rather silly. It's not socialism if by socialism you mean what it has mostly meant over the last 150 years, namely an alternative to capitalism, a different way of organizing economy and society than capitalism. When governments take over enterprises, they might have that plan to get rid of capitalism and replace it with socialism. But there's no necessity of it, and all the examples I just gave you are examples of the government taking over enterprises with absolutely no interest in and no movement towards replacing capitalism with socialism. Indeed, that was made clear in Argentina when they decided to take over the Argentinian subsidiary of the Spanish oil company. They were not making a move against capitalism. They were deciding that the behavior of that corporation inside Argentina was having such adverse effects on the Argentinian economy that they would be better off as a society to have that run by the government. That is pretty nearly exactly the decision made by the Bush administration, endorsed then by the Obama administration, to have the government of the United States take over AIG, the largest private capitalist insurance company in the world, because the interests of the United States required doing no less. Let me then turn to the other side of this question. Is it possible for the government to take over enterprises and to have it have something to do with socialism? And the answer is, of course, that's possible. It is possible for the government to take over enterprises and to intend that takeover to be part of a transition from capitalism to socialism. In the past, here's what that's meant. And I'll use as an example the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Revolution happens in 1917, the new socialist government does what? First, it announces that it's going to take over industrial enterprises. It's important for those of you that are interested in the actual history of the Soviet Union as opposed to the fantasies usually disclosed about it to remember that most people in Russia in 1917 when they made their revolution were peasants, people who lived on the land and who did agriculture as their way of life. The Soviet government in 1917 did not propose to take over the land. On the contrary, the new government of Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin, and the others promised the mass of people and indeed gave the mass of the people private ownership in the land. Private, not state ownership. The state didn't take over the most important part of the economy, agriculture. What the state did take over was industry. It took over industrial corporations, manufacturers, bankers, and so on. Those were made state enterprises. And not only that, but they told the private enterprises that they weren't going to pay for it. So it was not only a takeover, it was what is called expropriation. It's when you take over a property without paying anything for it. In Argentina, they are paying for what they did. The only debate there is how much they pay. But in the Soviet Revolution, they weren't going to pay. Well, what did the Soviet Revolution therefore mean? The government took over the enterprises, and here's what it did. It hired the workers. So the government becomes, in effect, the employer in industry, not in agriculture, but in industry. And the government not only becomes the employer, the government, therefore, makes the profit. if what the workers produce in industrial enterprises is worth more than the cost of having them produce it, the difference between the revenues and the cost, the profits of the enterprise, become the profits gathered by the government because it owns and operates the enterprises. And so in that situation, the government takeover was part of a transition. But now let's examine a transition to what? To an industrial society in which the industries were owned by the government was the employer, the government gathered into its hands the profits, and the government developed an economic plan. Soviet Union was quite famous for that, developing its five-year plans in which the government decided what would be done with the output, who would get it, how much would be produced in the way of consumer goods for the people, and so on. We typically call this kind of idea of socialism government ownership and government planning. And we distinguish it from private capitalism, where a private enterprise owns the operation, and we don't use planning to move outputs and inputs around. We use the market. So capitalism is private ownership and the market, and this kind of Soviet socialism is state ownership and state planning. Once this was established in the Soviet Union, and as fast as it was established, socialists, Marxists, and those interested in this kind of a thing began to have pretty bitter debates. Was what the Soviet Union did, taking over industrial enterprises, operating them, hiring the workers, planning the flow of inputs and outputs, was this really socialism? Or was it not? And there were as many on one side as on the other much of the time. Here was what was at stake. The critics of Soviet socialism argued that having the state take over didn't change the basic lives of people in the way that the socialist movement had always spoken of. Their idea was the following. A genuine socialism, a genuine passage beyond capitalism, requires more than having state officials replace private individuals on the boards of directors of big companies. It has to do with much more than replacing bureaucrats doing planning, having that instead of markets where we all haggle with one another, company to company, company to individual, and so on. Those kinds of socialist critics of the Soviet Union argued that a major further step was required and criticized the Soviet Union for not taking that step. And here was the basic idea. In order for socialism to really be established, you have to put the mass of people really in charge of the society. The problem with capitalism was, they argued, that it was always a minority, the major shareholders in corporations who handpicked the boards of directors who made all the decisions. To get rid of them, which for socialists was a good idea in terms of taking away their positions, was not to be replaced by having a handful of state officials or political party officials do that job instead. That would just get rid of one minority and substitute another minority. The whole point was to fundamentally change the society so that democratically the mass of people would be in charge of their own economic situation. And that, these critics argued, the Soviet Union, and for that matter, the People's Republic of China, Cuba, and so on, still had not done, and I still have not done to this day. And so that criticism remains. The answer of the Soviets was, we can't do that. History isn't ready for that. The mass of people lack the capacity, lack the discipline, lack the training, whatever, and can't be expected to do that. So that socialism has to be limited to state ownership and planning instead of private ownership and markets. Whether you come down on one side or the other of that question, the bottom line here is that government takeover doesn't necessarily give you a transition to a new and post-capitalist society. That is simply a mistake. When hysterical businessmen and women denounce the government for taking something over and use the phrase socialism, they're not understanding what the history of government takeovers has been and what it's meant for capitalism. To call Obamacare socialist, to try to get people motivated to be opposed to something by calling it socialist when all you can point to is that the government takes a bigger hand, then you have a lot of very difficult explaining to do. Is it socialist that we have public schools? Is it socialist that we have public postal system? Is it socialist that we have etc., etc.? Does that threaten capitalism, or does it in fact subsidize it? Does it strengthen capitalism, or does it undermine it? These questions are shunted aside in a kind of sloganeering that can be corrected if you simply take a look at the very varied historical situation governing how, when, and why governments take over the enterprises or start enterprises themselves. By the way, if I had more time to go into this, I would also explain that in many other countries, governments are asked by capitalists to take over many more things. For example, public transportation, public utilities like oil, gas and water and so on are common in many European countries, as are all kinds of insurance programs and the particular production of certain kinds of commodities. This is normal in the history of capitalism, has been widely supported by private capitalists who've gotten all kinds of benefits from this situation. Typically, also, the government is called upon to save corporations when they are defunct, to save the whole society when corporations are big and their failure would threaten everybody else, as in the example of AIG. So I hope that answers some of the various kinds of questions that have been raised when people have talked to me about the significance, the meaning, the implications of government taking over private enterprise. That is by itself not socialism. That's not what it's been. The question of socialism is fundamentally different. A government takeover can but need not lead to anything socialist at all. Let's take our short midpoint break, get some nice blues music, and then we'll come back for the second half of today's economic update.
Still party till my life. What can it be but homie if they pies up in the sky? Don't you know something's kind of funky and I wanna know why? 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 Tell me.
Second half of today's economic update. I want to turn to answering the question in that song we just heard, why? And I want to answer it in relationship to something of a mystery that has been unfolding and that has caused many of you to communicate it to me. And here's the way, or at least one way it could be put. We are now in a very deep, long-lasting economic crisis. After all, as I like to remind folks, the official beginning of this downturn was December of 2007. That means we are nearing the midpoint of the fifth year of this crisis. And because it has affected so many millions of people losing their jobs, so many millions losing their homes, because it's lasting so long, because people are out an average number of weeks of unemployment that is longer than any downturn we've had for decades. This crisis, therefore, has lent itself to comparison with the last major breakdown of capitalism as a system in this country. And I'm referring, of course, to the 1930s and what we now call the Great Depression, a collapse that began in October of 1929 and really didn't end until early of the year 1941. So we're talking about an 11 or 12-year crisis, lasted a very long time. If we use that as a benchmark, we're not even halfway through what it may turn out to be this time as well. But what is very striking about a difference between the 1930s and the crisis today hinges on a very peculiar phenomenon. When the crisis hit in the Great Depression, the new president, a man named Franklin Roosevelt, elected in 1932, was considered a centrist, rather like President Obama is considered today. He talked about balanced budgets. He talked the kind of relatively conservative, anti-deficit, reduce the budget debts of the country, and so on. And yet, shortly after he takes power, in 1933 and 1934, the president, Roosevelt, undergoes a stunning change, and his policies undergo a stunning change. We don't hear about austerity. We don't hear about balancing the budget. We don't hear anymore in the 1930s, when Roosevelt changes, about the need to cut government employment the way we hear it today. We don't hear about the need to cut back services to people the way we hear it about it today. I want to look at that with you, and I want to analyze it. First, let's be as clear as we can with as much drama as I can muster. What did Roosevelt do in the depths of the Depression of the 1930s that is so different from what is being done now? Well, let's see. First of all, the Depression conditions were worse than they are today. For example, in 1933, the official unemployment rate was 25%. That's three times worse than what it officially is today. Wow. In those years, with such enormous unemployment, there was widespread poverty and real desperation. You can imagine the condition of city, state, and the federal budget. With that many people out of work, they weren't paying taxes. That plunged the government into tremendous difficulty. They weren't bringing in the tax revenues to pay for all the things government normally did. Police department, fire department, public schools, maintaining the roads, the whole list. So you can imagine that there would have been calls, wow, if the government hasn't got this money, it's going to have to cut back. But you would have been wrong. Because what Roosevelt did in the midst of a depression, much worse than what we have so far in this one, what Roosevelt did was the opposite. I'm going to give you the three major examples of what Roosevelt did. First, he announced the establishment of an entirely new system called Social Security. We had never had that before in the United States. The president announced, in the midst of a depression, that the government was going to spend a ton of money. Doing what? Helping old people. Providing a pension to everybody 65 years of age or older who had spent a lifetime of work either in the home or on the job or both, as a matter of their rights as citizens. Wow. And of course, one of the reasons Roosevelt did this was to help in the Depression. It meant that old people were going to get some help, not a handout of charity, not a welfare, but rather a recognition that a lifetime of labor given to this country got you in return a reasonable pension for your old age as a kind of thank you and appreciation for what you had done. But the interesting thing is he created Social Security. What is being debated in Washington today is the exact opposite. Reducing Social Security payments, making you wait longer till you're 67, 8, or 9 to become eligible. So in the 30s, when the Depression was worse and government had less money coming in, they created a program, whereas today, when we're a much richer society and the Depression we have is much less severe, we're not only not increasing a Social Security system, we're cutting it. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. Roosevelt in the 30s did a second thing, also involving a huge expenditure of money at a time when the government supposedly didn't have it. He declared the establishment of an unemployment compensation system. We had never had that in the United States before either. This meant that every unemployed American who lost his or her job through no fault of their own, simply because the employer couldn't hire them anymore since the employer couldn't sell what they helped to produce because of the economic downturn, such workers would get 1-2 years of weekly unemployment compensation payouts. And remember, you had a 25% unemployment. 1 out of 4 workers was eligible for these payments. And of course, here again, Roosevelt was helping the mass of people negatively impacted by the crisis. He helped them with a pension for their elderly, and now he was helping them with an unemployment check while they weren't working. But now the third thing that Roosevelt did, he announced the following. If the private sector, if private capitalism of the 1930s either could not or would not provide work for the tens of millions of unemployed workers who wanted jobs and were ready to work, then, said President Roosevelt, there's no alternative but for me as president to provide jobs. And between 1934 and 1941, Roosevelt created and filled 12.5 million federal jobs. He put, in other words, a huge number of the unemployed back to work, having a job, earning a decent income, able to make their mortgage payments so they could keep their homes, etc. What are we doing today? Today there is no federal employment program. Not only has President Obama not created what Roosevelt did, he hasn't even proposed it. It's not that he tried and the Republicans rejected it. Neither Republicans nor Democrats are even discussing what the last president did in a similar economic downturn, even though he's from the same political party, the Democratic Party. So we are stuck with a remarkable dichotomy and a remarkable difference. The last time capitalism breaks down, the president comes roaring in with enormous outlays of money. Whereas today, with a lesser depression, at least so far, none of our leading officials seems to be able to imagine, let alone propose, a comparable or anything like a comparable program of helping the mass of people damaged by an economic crisis they did not cause. What's going on here? Well, the answer that I want to bring to your attention may surprise you a little bit. The answer is not that in the 1930s, there was belief in the leadership of the country, in the theory or the program of government intervention in an economy when capitalism breaks down. That kind of theory that the government needs and can step in is associated with a very famous British economist named John Maynard Keynes, spelled K-E-Y-N-E-S, who was the leading economist in Great Britain in the middle of the 1930s, and who looked around him at the Great Depression and came up with the fairly obvious argument that capitalism wasn't working real well, and that if you leave capitalism to its own devices, it breaks down, and sometimes in catastrophic ways, and that therefore we need to understand why that happens, and we need to tell the government how to step in to either prevent such things or at least to make them go away quickly and not hurt too many people. And he developed a theory and a program of behavior that has since come to be called either Keynesian economics or Keynesianism for short. Some people want us to believe that the advisors around President Roosevelt in the 30s were somehow suddenly converts to Keynes's theories or to Keynesian thinking, and that's why the president changed. And they like to believe that this is a superior way of understanding capitalism. It recognizes capitalism's weaknesses and flaws, and it has come up with this ducky nice government intervention program to get us around capitalism's difficulties, to either prevent these crises from happening or to make them short and shallow rather than long and deep. I would respectfully like to disagree. I don't think President Roosevelt had a great theoretical breakthrough, and I don't think his advisors did either. I think there's a very different explanation for what happened in the 1930s that has the nice advantage of also explaining why what Roosevelt did then is so different from what Bush and Obama have done so far now. Here's the explanation. In the 1930s, when the economy fell off the wagon, when millions lost their jobs, millions lost their homes, poverty stared everybody in the face, three things happened, and they all very similar. First, we had the most profound, far-reaching labor union movement that the United States has ever seen. We never had such a thing before, and we've never had it since. In a matter of months, millions of American workers in our major industries, auto, steel, chemicals, rubber, and so on, joined unions for the first time. They were organized under something called the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. That's the same thing as later merged to become the AFL-CIO. Our modern union movement. But then it was powerful. It was dynamic. It was what was happening to working people across America. And as millions joined these unions, two other things were going on that were just as important. First, a number of socialist parties that had existed and existed in important ways in many parts of the United States got much stronger. Hundreds of thousands of Americans affected by the crisis, able in a very practical, concrete way in their own personal lives to see that this was an economic system that didn't work well, had decided to join the Socialist Party, to make changes that would really do something to prevent these kinds of crises from having these kinds of devastating effects on people's lives. They joined the Socialist Party, and they began to agitate in big cities, in little towns, in schools, in churches, in neighborhoods, in sports clubs, all across American society. They began to spread their arguments about the limits, the flaws, the shortcomings of capitalism, and the advantages of a social transition to a better system for serving the major needs of the majority of people. And alongside the socialists, we also had the surge of a new and powerful Communist Party here in the United States, which was able to gain footholds in a number of industries, a number of parts of the United States, and to become quite influential. So we had a union movement, a socialist movement, a communist movement. Many of the people in each of these was also active in the others. That is, the CIO was the place where lots of socialists and communists did their work. And so you had an influence on the economy through the unions, on politics by so many people talking about this, and on our culture, because socialists and communists were interested in affecting how people thought about society and thought about life in general. Together, the union drives, the socialists and the communists, basically turned to the President of the United States and said, "We are mobilizing millions upon millions of people. You must do something for us in this period of capitalism's breakdown, or else you're going to force us, as well as invite us, as well as encourage us, to make our arguments that capitalism is the system of the past and socialism or communism that of the future. And we can show you, by the millions of people we can get into street demonstrations, that we can get to join unions, that we can get to create socialist clubs and communist clubs that produce newspapers and magazines and you name it, that we are a political force to be contended with." And I think in the marches they ran, in the demonstrations they held, they sent an unmistakable message to the president and to the business community. You're going to have to do something, because if you don't, your whole system may not survive. Roosevelt was a smart politician. He understood what was being said to him, and he was ready to make a deal. And so here's what he did. He went to the business community, and after all, let's remember, Roosevelt came from one of the richest, oldest, best families in America. His relatives had been president before him, etc. He knew these people, and they knew him. And they all saw those demonstrations in the streets. He said to them, "I need to take care of the American people, because if we don't, we're not going to stay in our positions as capitalists much longer. Our system has broken down. We have to do massive amounts of repair, and we have to take care of the mass of people while we do so. And the only way to pay for that is for you, gentlemen," he said, "you big businesses, you top executives, you're going to have to cough up the money." And he convinced enough of them, not all of them, by the way, not by a long shot, but he convinced enough of them that he was right, that they faced a threat to capitalism as a system if they didn't act, that they went in on the deal. They would back Roosevelt. They would give him the money, huge taxes on business, huge taxes on the rich, plus lots of loans, because they didn't want to just be taxed. They preferred loans to taxes, as those folks always do. But a combination of lending to the government and paying huge taxes would give Roosevelt the money to do what? Well, I've told you, to create Social Security, to create the unemployment compensation program, and to hire 12.5 million people to do all kinds of socially useful work. Wow. Roosevelt took the promise of the business community, and he went to the unions and the socialists and the communists, and he said to them, "I got a deal for you. I'm going to create an enormous apparatus of programs to help unemployed and working people on a scale you've never seen before. But in exchange, you've got to shut up about going beyond capitalism." All that stuff about socialism and communism, you can talk a little bit about it, but that's got to be gone. You've got to say that this program of Social Security, unemployment compensation, and public employment is wonderful, and you've got to back me. That's the deal. I'll get that done. You've got to back me. And the unions and the socialists and the communists, in the main, bought the deal, just like most of the business community, or at least a large chunk of it, did. And that was the alliance, the quote-unquote progressive wing of the business and rich community on the one hand, and the union, socialists, and communists on the other, with a few dissenters on both sides. By the way, that's why Roosevelt was reelected four times, something no other president had ever achieved before. He put together an incredibly powerful combination. It wasn't Keynesian economics or a new theory from England that changed the president. It was massive pressure from below. The turn to Keynesian economics was simply the form. And beyond the form of doing this, it allowed the people in charge to flatter themselves that it was clever students at Harvard who read the book from the famous economist in England who came up with this plan. No, that's not quite right. That's the revisionist history that's get written later. The reality is it was pressure from below. And now isn't that interesting? Because if you ask why in today's economic crisis, with massive unemployment, massive home foreclosures, massive Americans feeling pinched at every turn economically, why is it we don't have an expansion of Social Security? On the contrary, we're cutting it. Why we don't have a government employment program? We don't even talk about it. The answer is not that somehow Keynesian economics isn't strong. The answer is we don't have a mass movement from below, at least not yet. Occupy Wall Street may be the first step in that process, but we don't have it yet. And that's why we don't have the kind of response from the government that people were able to get in the 1930s. It isn't about Mr. Obama or Mr. Roosevelt, and it certainly isn't about Keynesian economics versus some other kind of economics. What happens in the realm of politics, like what happens in the realms of economic theory, is shaped by what is happening on the ground in the real world of the mass of people as they try to live their lives. Thank you very much for being with me today. We've spent a little extra time on these two major questions because so many of your comments have asked us to. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. I look forward to being with you again next week.
Won't be long. Thing gonna change. Sometime in the middle of the night, it's so long, it's so long, it's so long. Thing gonna change, thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Thing gonna change. Further on up the road, baby. Thing gonna change. My time, baby.